Welcome to the Classic Film Jerks. We are the jerks. This is our show. We watch the films that are so old, really good. And this will determine the winner of the show, and then we'll tell you what our verdict is. This is long enough for an intro song. Let's close and get to the show.
Hello, and welcome to the New Classic Film Jerks. This is the show where we try to figure out if all those classic films are indeed just that. My name is Evan Hansen, and I am your host. And tonight, I'm joined by a man who makes a bag on the head look good, Jeff Simmagee.
You got to know how to rock the bag on the head. I know a lot of people will say that it's a hat on a hat to wear a bag on your head and then a jaunty cap, but there are a few of us who can pull this off. It is me and John Merrick. We'll talk about the jaunty hat on a hat later.
We will talk about that jaunty hat. But as Jeff alluded to, tonight we watched 1980's The Elephant Man, directed by David Lynch and starring John Hurt, Anthony Hopkins, Anne Bancroft, and Sir John Gielgud. This movie has a 92% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes and was nominated for 8 Academy Awards and is credited for spurring the development of the Best Makeup category. Here are a couple reviews. Vincent Canby wrote, "Mr. Hurt is truly remarkable. It can't be easy to act under such a heavy mask. The physical production is beautiful, especially Freddie Francis's black and white photography." Roger Ebert wasn't so generous, writing, "I kept asking myself what the film was really trying to say about the human condition as reflected by John Merrick, and I kept drawing blanks." Jeff looks shocked right now.
What?
Listen.
How on earth can you not know what this film is trying to say when, just when you think you have it figured out, the nurse literally tells you what this film is about? I thought I was so smart. I was taking a note, and I was just like, "Oh, I'm going to wow everyone who listens with this." And then the nurse says, "Oh, it's because of that." I'm like, "Oh, all right. I guess I'm not that smart."
Hey, listen, we're going to talk a little bit about that Ebert review because it is definitely influential on how I viewed this film. But before we do, let's have a quick IMDb synopsis. A Victorian surgeon rescues a heavily disfigured man who is mistreated while scraping a living as a sideshow freak. Behind his monstrous facade, there is revealed a person of kindness, intelligence, and sophistication. Well, we're a couple jerks who haven't seen it, and now we have. Jeff, when you suggested we do a David Lynch movie, instantly came to mind The Elephant Man, a movie I have purposely avoided for 44 years.
Oh, wow. All right, let's unpack this. You said it's because of Ebert. So Ebert ruined this movie for you?
It wasn't so much Ebert. So as a young man, listen, Gene Siskel loved this movie.
And you wanted to spite him. So that's why you didn't watch it.
No, I was a big fan of Sneak Previews, their show on public television, their movie review show. And I remember being a 10-year-old kid and watching this, and the clips they showed from The Elephant Man were so disturbing to me. They upset me in ways I think intrinsically I thought of myself as a little bit of a weird kid, and I did not like the idea of someone being exploited for being weird. And I had already seen like Halloween by this point, okay? so I had seen horrible movies, but this got under my skin, and I'm like, every time it was available to watch, I'm like, no, that's that movie.
It's so fascinating because, like, I can totally see that, because there's a difference between the imaginary horror of a Halloween, right, and this true story of a person that, you know, when you're 10 and when you're young, you see this, it looks like a monster, and then people say, well, this is true. You know, I can definitely feel that for you.
Yeah, and as I said, 44 years of my life, I have avoided this film every time it's come on, even though I've heard such very good things about it, especially about the cinematography, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But
so what clips did they show? Was it the elephant attack in the beginning? Was it the dream sequence in the middle? Was it just the two very Lynchian parts of it? Or was it non-Lynchian parts?
In fact, okay, get this. The studio would not allow them to show clips of Merrick without the bag on his head.
Ah, that makes sense. Now, that's crazy!
I know!
Whoa! Okay, so talking about the theme of this film...
Yes, yes.
Whoa!
Yeah, and in fact, Ebert called that out. He's like, the studio's just running a new freak show. The studio's asking you to drop your $4 to see what the freak they've created.
Yeah, Ebert, they know. David Lynch knows. that is 100% the theme of this film is not being in control, like being a freak, being looked at for pay, being like the object of people's attention, and then to do that for the marketing, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and so why don't we just hop into it? So the Elephant Man, the story of John Merrick.
Actual name, Joseph.
Actual name, Joseph Merrick.
But the doctor, in writing his details of the account, said, no, John. And in fact, when in his original manuscripts, he was writing about Mr. Merrick, sometimes he wrote Joseph Merrick and then crossed it out and wrote John over the top of it. Why? No one knows.
Maybe it's because, listen, I don't want to cast stones at Victorian England, but they were not huge fans of my Jewish friends. So they did not want a Jewish sounding name like Joseph.
Oh, yeah. You think of, Joseph being too interesting. I assume that there is some sort of racism involved in this, honestly. And by all accounts, the doctor, Treves, is it, played by Anthony Hopkins, was not a great man, like a nice man. But anyway, yeah, continue.
So this story is the story of, in a fictionalized account, how he was found in a circus freak show. Dr. Treves brings him to an old-timey Victorian hospital for treatment.
Well, not even for treatment, honestly. The first time he brings him there, it's just like, hey, I want to get a gander at this guy and like what's going on with him.
And I want to use him to advance my career by showing him up.
Absolutely.
Notice his genitals are
unfinished. Okay. What was that about? Okay, so yeah, he's showing him off to his colleagues, and he's kind of saying, like, look, you know, the whole right arm is unusable, left arm untouched, as well as his genitals, which, what's the actual phrase?
Are completely normal. Or
something like that. Why did we point this, I don't know. It did stand out as a little strange. Did it kind of feel... to you, like that was a setup for some thing that went unsaid in this movie?
I thought it might have been a setup for, later on, you know, he's going to get with a woman and then he's going to be accused of rape or something. But nothing ever came of it. It was just mentioned, it was genitals, normal.
Well, part of me kind of wondered if there was a setup between Bites, the guy that owned him and was showing him off, because at one point Bites gets real, you got to return my man to me. And I couldn't tell if they were trying to code it a certain way that there was, but nothing was overt. It was kind of left there. And I like your interpretation of pointing out the perfectly normal genitals to set up this fear of him being a true monster later and doing something, Frankensteinian rather than I don't know, making it, making these, I, whatever. Yeah.
Well, the weird thing to me, well, among the, I mean, this is a David Lynch film, so there are, there are some weird things in this movie. The weird thing to me about the relationship, he had with him is, and he was the runner of the freak show at, at first, is looking back, and I can see your point, because he looked at him in other ways, you know. I don't know what the actor was trying to convey, but you didn't just see greed in his eyes.
Yeah, you know, and it was, I don't know if he was trying to portray, like, drunkenness or a lust or a lechery, like, but I don't know. I do feel like there was maybe something there where in the 80s they weren't going to put that on the screen, but Lynch knows enough to kind of add in these subtle uncomfortable moments about, like, why does this person want this property back? Like, what's his full extent of it? Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah. Speaking of uncomfortable moments, this movie's filled with them. This movie is uncomfortable to watch. When Merrick is brought to the hospital, Hopkins' daughter, Treves, begins showing him off to society, people. And in some ways, that felt more exploitive to me than the freak show. There's a scene where he's at a dinner with a society couple, and they are obviously disgusted to have dinner with him. And, you know, this is the scene I think you mentioned earlier. They hang a light on this. They have a nurse say to Hopkins, "Hey, what are you doing to him?"
Yeah. "You made him into another freak, Gav." Yeah. Where it's like he's now a new type of freak where he's a fad. You know, like it's cool for society to have dinner with John Merrick. And despite Merrick being a very erudite and well-learned and well-spoken, soft-spoken, kind person, you know, all they see is the freak, and that's why they want to have dinner with him. Not to, like, converse, but just to say that they had dinner with him. And I was like, oh, he's become a new type of freak, a fad. And then the nurse was like, he's become a new type of freak. I'm like, oh, all right, well, yeah. So yeah, they definitely do hang a lantern on it. And, but I think it was great. Like, and I think that's one of the reasons why this film to me comes off as, how do we frame this without ourselves sounding pretentious about it? But it's a really great movie that has stuff to say that says it and doesn't make the audience feel dumb in saying it. Like, we were allowed to kind of, like, figure that out before someone told us. So in that regards, it's kind of like how they say about murder mystery movies, where the audience really loves figuring things out for themselves before the detective does. It makes them feel smart. And I think David Lynch did a really excellent job here, where I felt like I was seeing the subtext, you know, even though he then made it text.
Yeah, and that's the thing. He always did right down to the end. You know, he laid it out, what's going on, which both works, I think, for it and against it. And as I said, this is very much a David Lynch film with, you know, some occasionally shots that you're like, okay, are we moving the story along here? Jeff, what did you think was happening in that opening scene with the mother and the elephant?
That's that. Once again, that was my question, is like, is this a truly uncomfortable thing, or is this just arty? But I think he knew he was filming it to make it seem like there was some sort of sexual congress between the elephant and the woman. But the true story, or the film story, is that she was pregnant with John Merrick when she was attacked by an elephant. But in true Lynchian style, it is a horrific nightmare attack, like looping frames and blurring. And I mean, I don't know if it's just because I'm looking at this with jaded 2024 eyes, where I just think everything is an allusion to some sort of sexual misconduct or rape or lust. Yeah, but like I was like, what am I watching? But it's just like I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, no, he 100% knew what he was doing, and I think it struck many audiences that way at the time because it is just unavoidable. I mean, the way, like you said, the way he filmed it, it is because it looks like she's on her back.
Yeah, she's thrashing around. Yeah. She's saying like no, or like she's screaming in a way that could be screams or interpreted as pleasure. Yeah, I mean, my note here that I followed up with was, whew, not sex. I was never more happy to write that down. Let's talk overall. Okay, in 1980 we had color film, believe it or not. So black and white is a choice. What do you think that choice was for David Lynch? Why black and white for this, Evan? Was it purely technical to kind of hide the makeup? Was it simply just, hey, this is an old story, make it black and white?
Honestly, I think yes, it hides some flaws in the makeup, especially, you know, around the coloring of the prosthetics. You know, by this time, Young Frankenstein had been made in the mid-70s in black and white and was a tremendous success. And I think the visuals of Young Frankenstein were very stark.
Mm.
And I think that may have inspired some filmmakers to say, hey, I can use black and white film, especially a high contrast black and white film, which this was, to really kind of say something that the story needs to be said, but also reinforced on screen. So there's a lot of pitch black in this movie. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of pitch black, and everything in London seems dark outside. And I don't think we get one scene in this movie that's outside that's during the day, do we?
Gosh.
You know, we look out the window during the day, but I don't think.
There was one. It was at the fair, like when we first are at the freak show. I think that's daylight. And I only remember that because I remember there being balloons. And one of my questions is, was it fun for kids to hold a balloon like back then? And so kids would have been out, so that should have been daylight, but it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't like super bright. Yeah. I mean, I just like the starkness, the bleakness,
right.
I think,
right.
Like,
I mean, there are scenes of this movie of just industrial smokestacks belching into the sky.
Oh, so one of my favorite subplots of this, so, you know, it starts out with Anthony Hopkins working on a man who's been ground up by a machine, and he's trying to save his life. And from that point on, every time you see a machine, it is doing nothing. There's a guy like feeding water into this machine that's just bubbling on the street. There are these four men holding these like iron seesaws and just pushing them back and forth across a table. There's just like guys like using wood to just like pound on the ground while a thing goes behind it. All these machines doing nothing. And I was just like, he didn't need to put that layer in here, but we are around like the machine revolution, you know, things are changing. People think machines are better, this contrast versus the modern, while still having an old timey freak show, something very, old and out of fashion. But then to also say like, look, machines are aren't that great. Like, it's just like a nice little David Lynch thing to be like, hey, Charlie, I want to show you modernization is happening, but it's bunko, you know? Well, like, it's so good.
It's time to feel smart now because the machines chew up the workers just like the machine of the entertainment industry chewed up John Merrick.
Oh,
and David
now we're
Lynch.
Talking. Yeah. I mean, and David Lynch. Yeah. I mean, he shouldn't have taken the Dune role, the Dune job. But I'm so glad he did. I think he's okay. You know, I don't think he's wanting for much. Well, can we
go ahead.
Introduce a new segment? What were we going to call it? Checkout Chekhov. I don't think I've ever seen a film introduce. So for those unaware, the thing called Chekhov's gun is if you want to shoot a gun in the third act, you have to show it in the first. And here, Evan and I are using Chekhov's gun or Chekhov's corner or Chekhov as a reference to a thing that will come back in the third act that was highlighted in the first. This is the first time I've ever seen Chekhov's head, Evan, where it is mentioned casually that John Merrick cannot lay down like a normal person because it will kill him. And I, as someone that loves to try and find the Chekhov thing that they're trying to set up in the third act, I lost it on that. I was like, I can't believe we're going to get a Chekhov's head.
Yes, we did. We, in fact, did get Chekhov's head. And it is really interesting because I think that was in probably the first 10 minutes of the movie that was mentioned.
Yeah, Bites is just like, oh, he has to sit asleep sitting up because he'll die if he lays down. And, like, sure, the note is like, well, how on earth could Bite know this? But it turns out, like, John Merrick knew this about himself in real life as well. This was a thing that everyone just assumed that the weight of his head was too much for his neck to support when laying down, and it would snap his neck. And spoilers, if you haven't seen the film, Chekhov's head.
But before we get to Chekhov's head,
Before
John Merrick decides to go gracefully into the night, he has a little adventure. He have too many adventures? Because it seems like we don't get a good sense of time in this movie.
Yeah,
but he does a lot to the fact where the Crown Princess of Wales is coming around the hospital to advocate for John Merrick.
Mm-hmm. You think American healthcare is bad, but in England, you need a note from the Queen in order to get to get healthcare. That's how he was saved, is that the Queen literally wrote a note saying, like, please save John Merrick. Yeah, it's true. And I wouldn't say that he does a lot. I would say he has a lot happen to him.
Yes, that is better.
I
was going to say he meets a famous actress, Madge Kendall, played by Anne Bancroft, who really is probably the first person in this movie that treats him not as a freak.
Mm-hmm.
Like she is interested in him because of the newspaper description, but her interactions with him were so different, even than Anthony Hopkins' interactions with him.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, I like where this is going so far. Well, yeah. I got bushwhacked by a couple turns.
Like this setup of her being a famous actress who lives her life being so fake or putting on faces of her own is the kindest to someone and is the most real her friend to John Merrick in the end. She doesn't ask anything of him. She's like the only person that doesn't take anything from him. It's
in fact, she gives him a gift And, you know, we'll come to the classic scene later, but I so wish that were the classic scene of the movie. I so wish that were the classic scene of the movie.
Where she gives him the photo of herself?
No. They're reading Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No. A lot of worse stuff has to happen in this
film. Lot of worse, including John getting kidnapped and taken back to the freak show. Oh, go ahead.
It does say one thing where one person can kidnap a freak and show him off and make an honest living. I mean, the economy has never been that strong again, where two people could live off of the showing off of one of the two. So Bite essentially like kidnaps him and brings him overseas, essentially for like a day. And then it's just like, I'm throwing you away. And then, I guess the other folks that never wanted anything from John are the other quote unquote freaks in the freak show, in France, where they just like, they're like, we're getting you out of here. Like, this is horrible for you. We're paying your way back. Like, such, I mean, we're kind of skimming over this and making jokes about it. But there was so much moving stuff in this. Like, your emotions are ripped, at least mine were, from just the horror of the tragedy of the things that people did to this man, contrasted with the beauty that he found in certain moments that were then so fleeting because someone would take it away from him. And just like, in the end, it was just like, he was such a good person. and like, I was like weeping at like how his life went. And It was just so sad, Evan.
Yeah, it was, and it's whiplash sad, you know?
Yes.
We see him going around, you know, getting to wear a suit and meeting people, and then we see, you know, after the hospital closed, the night watchman or, you know, the porter or whoever he is, bringing people by to gawk at him, to, abuse him, pour alcohol on him, showing his own face in the mirror.
Yeah.
It's just, like, back and forth, and I'm like, can this man never get any peace?
Yeah. Never get and any like peace. I have two contenders for the classic scene.
Let's hold back with the classic scene. But I wanted to talk to you real quickly. This movie, at least to my ears, almost scoreless.
Mm-hmm.
And then we hear Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, and I'm like, oh, this is it. This is it. Nothing good is going to happen now.
Yes. Yeah.
So, spoilers, John Merrick, after getting to see one of his dreams, they're getting to go to the theater.
Mm. Yes. The third Lynchian scene in this whole thing.
Third Lynchian scene.
Where I was like, what play are you watching? It starts with a man dressed as a cat jumping onto stage in front of fake waves. And then there's like horsemen and swans. I guess it's a pantomime, I suppose. But like, I honestly thought when she was like, oh, you got to come to the theater, John, you're going to love it. Like, I'm an actress. I'm like the most well-respected actress in England. You got to come to the theater. That we were going to see theater and not whatever that was. There was a shot of a toy mouse on a string just like moving across scenery. And I was like, oh, Lynch, you just can't help but be Lynch. That's why you made it a panto.
You cannot. I, too, was intrigued by Swan Cat Takes the Sea, or whatever the play was. but it so fills Merrick with happiness. Evidently, he decides it's never going to get any better than this. And quite frankly, you can see why he feels like this, because every other time he's gotten some happiness, whiplash his back. Yeah. And he decides to go to sleep on his back. Which, as Jeff talked about with Chekhov meant the end of him. Yeah, but did you hear his last words? His last words were, "It is finished."
Mm.
And I have to wonder, is David Lynch making a Jesus reference here? Because that, you know, John, you know, knew his Bible, knew the English Book of Common Prayer.
Yeah.
23rd Psalm was his favorite. "It is finished" is from John 19:30. Last words Jesus said before ascending to heaven. And then John lies down, and then we get another Lynchian scene that Roger Ebert compared to 2001 Star Child.
Oh, scene, yeah, absolutely.
Where he hears his mother's voice. And I'm like, oh, my God, David Lynch, you have broke my heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, now, just one thing. At this point, we also did learn, kind of as an aside, that John is dying before this as well. So just a little bit of extra setup.
That is true. But you're right.
But yeah, I think you really nailed something there. Like his life is almost Jobian, right? Like just trial after trial, except he does have those sweet moments that people try and give him or that he finds for himself. I think you're right. I think he's just like, look, tomorrow this is all going to go to shit. It has, like, it's almost like John Barrick is like, look, you've seen the last 2 hours, right? Like, if I don't stop this now, it's just going to be the cycle of this again. Oh, boy. Yeah, this movie really did a number on me, Evan. I did not expect it either.
Once again, my thing is, I thought I would be angry the whole time. But I was just heartbroken the whole time.
It's so weird because you think you will remain angry. You will remain, like, upset for what's happening to him. But then something wonderful happens, and you, like, feel – you stupidly feel happy for him. like thinking, like, he's making it, and then he doesn't. And you're tricked again into getting angry. And it's just this wonderful roller coaster of jerking you back and forth between these emotions that just makes it so powerful.
And now – so old.
So old.
Seeing how this movie was made in 1980 and set in Victorian England, some things may have changed. Let's start with healthcare in England. I can see why they got that National Health Service, because you used to have a board of old white men voting on whether or not you get to stay in the hospital.
Yep. I mean, to be fair,
you kind of got it now.
I mean, they're not trying to fix him. They're not, you know. Yeah, we do have that now. Healthcare. Sorry, just took a moment there. Really, just let that settle on top of me for a moment. As I think you understand. So I already said balloons, kids with balloons. That's definitely my first so old. But gaslights.
Gaslights is on my list too, because my whole time I was thinking, one, it's got to be so stuffy in there with all those gas lights. And two, it's got to be so dark they can't put out that much light. I've tried this at home.
And it's like, no wonder London burned down all the time. Like, there's just flames open.
Open flames everywhere.
Everywhere. Another sold hovels. You don't get good hovels like they used to have back in those days. Like when Treves went to go to Bites' hovel to get John Merrick, it was like a multi-room hovel. Like, you go downstairs and through a door. Sure, it's underground. There's like some water on the floor, but you got like five rooms all to yourself, hot and cold, running rats. You don't get that much anymore, you know?
How about cabbies that will hang out with you for about an hour and then take you back to where you started? The cab drivers in Victorian England had nothing else to do.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you can set your own wages to a living wage, yeah, I'll stick around for you. Why not? Yeah.
Despite, you know, this movie being rather old, the only other so old I have is every quote-unquote gentleman is dressed like they are meeting the queen all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, I mean, even Bites, he was wearing a suit, and he was, the scummiest of scum in this. Yeah.
Well, Jeff, you know, you've already talked about it. This isn't much of a hat town, but it is such a hat, we got to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
In the scenes where John Merrick has the bag with one eye hole on his head, he has the most spectacular hat. I can't even describe it.
It's like an old timey baseball player's pillbox hat. You know?
Well, okay. I cannot describe it, but somebody can.
Yeah, it has, it kind of, you know, it has that, that kind of, a Castro, Fidel Castro type of military, that kind of military cap.
Only but smushed.
Yeah, like flat on top, but huge. Like, he has to have gotten that handmade by someone. Like, that, you don't just get, I don't know, a size 14 hat.
Right, listen, the key thing, I'm looking for a hat that will fit over my bag. Can you help me?
Yeah. And that adds an extra, like, quarter of an inch at least. I mean, I get it. He is, in all intents and purposes, a genteel man, a gentleman. And so he's going to want to wear a hat. But it does seem, it's a little funny. It's a little funny.
It is a wonderful hat. This is a hat I owned right up there with you, crazy hat from Aiton.
It's the smallest hat town we've ever visited.
It is the smallest.
But also the largest hat town.
But also the largest. Well, Jeff, I think it's time I hear a classic scene alert. So you said you had two contenders. I said I wish so much it were the Romeo and Juliet scene, even though I know it's not, because that scene was so tender. So wonderful. She gave him a little kiss that you could just tell meant everything to him. But I know that's not the classic scene.
Yeah.
Jeff, what do you think the classic scene is?
Well, you know, what I was trying to thread together earlier when I mentioned the classic scene is what we see happen to this guy is so back and forth and so powerful that when you get to the classic scene that has become kind of a punchline and kind of a joke, it hits so hard and that you just want to like stand up and be like, damn straight, John Merrick, you are not an animal. Like, you are not an animal. Like, he's being crowded into a bathroom, into the back room of a bathroom between dirty urinals, and everyone's just piling on him, and he has just had it. And he says, no! And he just screams, I am not an animal. And Oscar, just throw the Oscar, throw it. It's like it hit. And for me, only knowing this touchstone as a joke, of just saying, I'm not an animal. Ah, it's the elephant man, you know, whatever. But like, boy, does that scene really hit. How about you?
Yeah, I have here right underneath, I wish it were Romeo and Juliet. I am not an animal.
Yeah,
and for all the reasons you said, you know, they take the bag off his head because this is when he is, after having escaped the freak show in Europe, coming back to London. I mean, he's being pursued because he accidentally knocked down a brat kid that was on the boardwalk. And when they pulled it back up and said, you know, the hair is out of control, and he's just had it, and he just wants to be treated with respect. And like you said, I knew the scene. I've seen clips. I've heard, you know, it's been parodied many times. But in this context, it is just so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. This movie made me feel a lot. Like a lot. Like, it makes you feel anger. It makes you feel hope. It makes you feel sad. Like, I don't know, peace, joy. Like, I was, this movie put me through the ringer, Evan, to the point where at the end, Emily was like, oh, so did you like it? Because she wasn't really watching. She was just like, you know, noodling on her phone. And I was like, they were so mean to him. And I like have tears streaming down my face. I'm just like, they didn't need to be so mean to him. Like, wow, Evan.
Yeah, I agree. But, Jeff.
You didn't cry because you're a heartless man.
I did not cry. because I am heartless. But, you know what I did cry about? The death of John Gielgud in 2000. No, it's because now, who isn't dead? Well, I would have thought, for this being one of our more recent films of the week, for the main cast, we would have had lots of survivors. However, the Grim Reaper has been about. Mm. John Gielgud did not surprise me, died in 2000. I was surprised that Anne Bancroft had died in 2005. And I was doubly surprised that John Hurt had died in 2017. I'm like, John Hurt is dead.
Yeah, but no, but he was just in Doctor Who, I said to myself.
Exactly, and then I realized what I said. Yeah. Exactly what I said.
You realized that was 10 years ago.
That's what was my thoughts is that he was just in Doctor Who 10 years ago.
Yep.
But the main cast, Anthony Hopkins, still alive, still working.
Still amazing. By the way, like, okay, so this was the two movies we watched in a row. We watched this one, not back to back, but the movie we watched right before this was Meet Joe Black, a movie with no merits, except that Anthony Hopkins knocks it the F out of the park in that. Like, I think it was the first time, because he was set against so many other trash people, trash actors, not doing their best work, that Emily and I were just like, there's something to this Anthony Hopkins guy. And then I put this movie on, and Anthony Hopkins, when he goes to see the Elephant Man, and we don't see that, the audience doesn't see that, the curtain pulls back, just a one shot close up on Anthony Hopkins' face. His face tells you everything you need to know about what he's seeing and how he's feeling. And I was just like, pen flip. I was like, this guy got it. And I know I'm late to this party because he's won many, many Oscars. And like, everyone knows that he's great. But I was just like, man, this Anthony Hopkins fella, huh? He's going places.
You heard about this up and coming Anthony Hopkins?
Yeah. So the cast, amazing, dead or alive.
Yeah, considering at this time, American audiences had probably not seen him in much. He had been in A Bridge Too Far. I don't know his filmography. But even in those early films, he is fantastic. So truly, truly a fantastic actor.
I mean, and
let me say this about Anthony Hopkins. Even when he is working with some maybe not the greatest material,
yeah,
he comes through. Absolutely.
He's serious about the craft. Yeah, and I think he loves it. Like, why else would he be in Meet Joe Black? Like, I don't know. Like, gave him a big paycheck.
He wanted to hear who was Brad Pitt speak patois.
Oh, I had no idea. Twice, two scenes, Evan. Two separate scenes, each one worse than the one before. But we will cover Meet Joe Black in our future classic film jerks. Is it a classic? We'll find out in 2053.
So, Jeff, what do you think? Should this movie be remade?
No, there's no need. What are you going to do? Have better makeup effects? What, like, no. Nah, see, no thanks.
I am more on the fence on this one because, you know, we've talked about the David Lynchianness of this movie, and part of me thinks that maybe that distracts a little bit from the story.
Mm.
And so I think maybe, yes, maybe it should be remade by even maybe an older David Lynch, you know?
No, it would be far weirder with an older David Lynch, because he don't give a fuck at this point. He made a short movie where he's interrogating a monkey. You think he would rein it in for a remake of this? No.
You're probably right, but well, someone could rein it in just a little.
What about this, Evan, a compromise? What if we just edit the three Lynchian segments, the opening, the dream sequence, and the end, and the play, and to take the Lynchian stuff out of it? Does that, should that version be remade?
Yeah. Okay. So now you're selling me, because quite frankly, I think it's going to be hard, to get acting of this, the quality that we saw in this film again. So yeah, maybe if there was a de-lynchified.
Colorized de-lynchified.
Colorized de-lynchified.
I mean, it's 2 hours long. I didn't even feel that length. And so I wouldn't even say it needs to be de-lynchified for me, really. Like 2 hours and 4 minutes. I was enwrapped, really, the whole time.
Honestly, I did not feel like any of the scenes went on too long, except the Lynchian scenes, as we said.
Yeah. And so, when I did feel like they went on too long, it was kind of the point. It was like when the porter comes with the people to gawk at him in his own rooms and like forcing him to kiss a woman against both of their wills. Like, and he just makes you sit in that uncomfortableness. But yeah, there were no scenes where it was just like
my least favorite scene of the movie, because it hurt so bad.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Folks, if you want to truly feel, if you want the real equivalent of the Voight Kampff test to find out if you're a synth or not, are you a skin job? If you're worried, watch this movie, and you will feel if you're not a robot.
I was going to say, getting a little too optimistic about humanity.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Well, Jeff, what if this movie was not made in 1980 and was being made today for the first time? You know what we like to do here is recast the movie with modern actors. Jeff, really, I only recast two people in this movie, and that would be John Merrick, Dr. Trevis, played by John Hurt, and Anthony Hopkins.
Mm.
And I'm looking at my choices, and I do not like either of them, honestly. So I hope you have an interesting casting.
Well, let's see. I'll just recast the two that you have. I'm going to do a little something a little bit different than the normal straight casting that I do. And in this one, Treves will be played by Jumbo the elephant that was electrocuted by Edison to prove that his direct current was better than alternating current. And in a twist, the Elephant Man will be played by Anthony Hopkins.
So, minor.
An all elephant cast, except for Anthony Hopkins as the Elephant Man. See what I'm doing?
Minor
there?
Correction. Jumbo was hit by a train and died. Topsy was electrocuted.
Topsy.
By
Jumbo got hit by a train?
Jumbo got hit by a train, yeah.
Oh, wow. Is this a conspiracy? Are we trying to kill off elephants in weird, weird ways? I mean, they pushed Dumbo off that cliff with a feather. They thought he was going to die.
For the Anthony Hopkins character, I chose David Tennant.
Okay, yeah.
Because I could see him both kind of exploiting Merrick, but then later feeling bad about exploiting Merrick. You know, kind of exploiting Merrick, but not realizing that he's exploiting Merrick.
Yeah.
And for John Merrick, I decided to give Daniel Radcliffe a turn.
Oh, yeah. He'd be great. That's perfect casting. Yes. Especially if this is going to be a play. You kidding? Yeah. Like, Daniel Radcliffe, I think, has already signed that contract. You just have to write that up. I mean, this is totally up his alley.
Oh, I know it'd be up his alley. I just, you know, he has a very expressive face, and behind some of that makeup, it really, you know, really rests on his eyes. So, yeah. It'd be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, think about, you know, some the other names don't jump to mind, but when this was on, it's not based on the Broadway play, but there was a Broadway play, a play about Elephant Man, and in one of the productions, David Bowie played John Merrick.
Really? Yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah. And so, to me, when you said
Daniel Radcliffe,
thank you. The name just like, I was like, this is absolutely the type of like weirdo thing that he does. And it just felt right knowing that David Bowie had played this character and like Daniel Radcliffe could play this character. I think that's great. Yeah. Now I'm mad that this doesn't exist.
You know what? That remake can still be made.
Just type the prompt into ChatGPT. I think it'll just spit out a movie for you, right?
Let's move on to our final judgment. We decide if this thing is a classic or not. Jeff, do you want to go first?
I loved this movie. I almost never want to see it again. But it's a hard watch. It's, I wouldn't say enjoyable, but it's great. I think it's a classic. I think it checks off all my boxes.
Yeah, I'm a little bit more ambivalent. I thought it was very good. Very beautiful to look at. Like you, I never want to see it again. This ranks up there with, like, very good movies I never want to see again. Kind of like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Uh-huh, absolutely.
Good movie I never, ever want to see again. Yep. I was so disturbed, you know, and once again, I carried this emotional baggage with me for 44 years.
Right.
But at the same time, I do have these Lynchian things that bother me. I think it could be a little better. I don't think Roger Ebert was right. at all.
There's our T-shirt. We don't think Roger Ebert was right.
Yeah. ClassicFilmDerbs.com. but is it a classic? And this is one of those things. It's so hard to say. Is every very good movie classic? No. Is this one a classic? No. I'm going to say soft no.
Okay. Is it because 1980 it feels too close to be a classic?
I just think it could have been executed a little better. I think it could have been as good as Lynch was about giving us that emotional whiplash, and as you know, as perfect as the acting was, and as beautiful as the wow, I'm really painting myself into a corner here. The cinematography is gorgeous. The acting is great. The emotions are full, but still, there's something wrong. I think what we have here is a 10-year-old child saying, "There's something still I don't like about this movie."
So yeah, that's the question I wanted to return to. Is you know, you had this perception of not wanting to watch it. Do you? Like, it sounds like watching it didn't fully resolve that for you. It wasn't, you're not going to go back in time and tell young 10-year-old Evan, like, you're wrong, you're going to love this movie. But it also sounds like you're not going to tell young Evan, you were right, this movie, it should be avoided. So, like, kind of where do you feel like you needed to wait 44 years to see it?
Honestly, I think I do. I think I needed probably 15 years of therapy so I could watch this movie without crying the entire way through.
Yeah. I've had years of therapy and I cried the entire way through too. But it was a nice catharsis.
10-year-old Evan would have cried the whole way and then written John Merrick fan fiction where, you know, he's not really dead. Now he has superpowers and he can get revenge on the people that abused him.
Oh, yeah. I will agree with that aspect of he should have superpowers. No, of like, I would not recommend 10-year-old Jeff watch this. This is way too emotional for 10-year-old Jeff. This is hitting all those boxes of things that were super triggers for 10-year-old Jeff. Fear of abandonment, feel of, you know, do people actually like me? You know, I'm a freak. Like, people are just staring at me. They're laughing at me. Like, dead parent anxiety. Like, now that I'm thinking about it, yeah, I'm so glad I didn't watch this when I was 10 years old, because this movie would have messed me up. And maybe that's why it resonated with me now, because I can look back and say, like, yes, this movie would have messed me up as a child. So yeah, don't let your 10-year-olds watch this. What are you doing? What are you doing?
Yeah, don't be the Hansen family, or my dad took me to see Godfather when I was 3 years old.
It's a family movie.
It's all about family.
Yeah, what? It's like you can't learn about family anymore.
Well, that was The Elephant Man. And Jeff, you know what time it is? We tell the listeners what we're going to be listening to, or what we're going to be listening to, what they're going to be listening to, and what we're going to be watching next month. Jeff, what is it?
Ooh, I think next month is The Them, a motorist is terrorized by a giant ant on a highway.
Closer than you've ever been, because we are watching 1971's Duel. Jeff, who directed this no-name piece of
cinema? It's a film by a little director that made a flash in the pan, and he's gone now. Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, so I'm sure we'll have nothing to say about his filmmaking style.
Yeah.
But right. Before then, if you wanted to tell us what we should be watching, get in touch with the Classic Film Jerks Facebook and Twitter and Blue Sky. Or email us at classicfilmjerks@gmail.com. Let us know what we should be watching, what you think of the new Classic Film Jerks, and more importantly, is The Elephant Man a classic? So, for Jeff Amagi, I'm Evan Hansen, saying his genitals are completely normal.
You just listened to an episode of the Classic Film Jerks, a part of the Atomic Geeks Podcasting Network.